Hey there, I'm so pumped to tell you about an amazing new community I've launched called Grief to Growth Circle Community. It's a space for people who are grieving to come together to support each other and for people who want to know who we are, why we're here, and where we're going to have those conversations, all the things we talk about on the podcast. So I invite you to join me at grieftogrowth.com/community to become part of this compassionate crew. The best part is 100% free. And you have access to me in addition to everybody else in the community. In fact, the podcast will be there so you can talk about the things we talk about in the podcast right there in the community. There's also some premium content if you want to go deeper in the work I'm doing, but mostly it's about building relationships and community and about sharing resources and supporting each other. So come on over and check it out. It's grieftogrowth.com/community. I'll see you inside.
Hi there. Welcome to the Grief to Growth podcast. Your host is Brian Smith, spiritual seeker, grief survivor, and life coach. Brian believes that the worst tragedies of life provide the greatest opportunity for growth. Brian says he was planted, not buried, and he's here to help you grow where you've been planted. In each episode, Brian and his guests will share what has helped them to survive and thrive. His sincere hope is that this episode helps you today.
Welcome to this special episode of Grief to Growth. In today's episode, I sat down with Reverend Dr. Terry Daniel to discuss her book, Grief and God, When Religion Does More Harm Than Healing. Terry's just written this book, and it's an excellent book on how religion can complicate grief, actually. In today's episode, we also sat down with a live audience who participates in the discussion and tells some of their stories about what they went through and how religion may have complicated their grief. So I hope you enjoyed. I thought it was a fantastic episode. And now, a brief word from our sponsor. When I decided I was going to do a podcast, I knew there were more moving parts than most people expect. How do you record a podcast? Where do you host it? How much will it cost? Do I need special software? How do I distribute it? All these questions were in my mind. I was all set to go with another podcast hosting company. Then I heard about Anchor. I believe that Anchor is the easiest way to make a podcast. Anchor gives you everything you need in one place. You can use it right from your phone or from your computer. Anchor is not only free, you can even make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership. Anchor's creation tools allow you to record and edit your podcast so it sounds great. They'll even distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard everywhere, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and many more. So download the Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. That's Anchor, ANCHOR.FM as in FM radio. And now back to our episode. Hello, everybody. My name is Brian Smith, and we're here today with Reverend Dr. Terry Daniel, who is the author of Grief and God, When Religion Does More Harm Than Healing. And what we're going to do this afternoon, for you in California, evening for me here on the East Coast, is we're going to talk about what we call toxic theology and how that can actually complicate the process of grief. So I want to welcome everybody here. And I see some friends in the waiting room. So thanks for joining us. And I'll turn it over to Terry.
Hey, everybody. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming. And thank you for those of you that are on my email list and got the message today. And thank you, Brian. Brian, my co-host and moderator, is very involved with a group called Helping Parents Heal. Hi, Stanley. He works with a lot of bereaved parents. He lost his teenage daughter a few years ago. And Brian and I have become friends over the years because not only is Brian a parent who has experienced the death of a child, but he also grew up in an evangelical setting. So we've had a lot to talk about regarding the grieving, mourning experience and how religion impacts that. So we're going to kind of just let this be a free-flowing conversation. If you want to jump in and ask a question, there are two ways to do it. If you take your mouse and run it along the bottom part of the black screen where you see everybody's picture, no, that's not where it is. Yes, you'll see a thing that says participants or something like that. And on your right-hand side, you'll see your name and a little thing where you can raise your hand. It says raise hand. Now, if you can't see that, just click on the window that says chat at the bottom of your screen, and you can type your question in, and we will open up your microphone and let you speak. Is that right, Brian? Am I saying this right?
Yeah, we have a fairly small group, so if everybody will respect it, well, you can unmute yourselves, and we can try it that way. If you have a question or you want to interject something.
I see an old friend of mine right here that I haven't seen for a really long time. Oh my God, hold on. Oh, this is great. I so love that all of you guys are here. Thank you so much. Edwina, hi. Oh my gosh, it's been forever. Okay, so we are here to talk about what is commonly known as toxic theology. And I'll start by talking about where that term comes from. In my new book, Grief in God, When Religion Does More Harm Than Healing, I talk about how in my undergrad, where I went to school to get my degree in religious studies, I was telling a professor of mine about something that happened with another professor. And he said, well, that guy's just practicing bad theology. And that's where I first heard the term bad theology. And it became so big in my awareness after that, that I began to see it everywhere. And then it sort of morphed into toxic theology, because nowadays we have toxic relationships, toxic masculinity, toxic parents. So toxic everything is kind of a thing now. So toxic theology, we'll talk about what that is. But I am specifically working on toxic theology as it impacts the grief process. So I think I'm going to just start by giving a very broad, very general example. If your loved one, let's say your teenage son, died by suicide, and you happen to believe that all suicides go to hell, then in addition to all the processes you're going through with your grief, you're also having a spiritual crisis about, is my loved one in hell? And if he is in hell, this means that I'm never going to see him again because I'm a good Christian and I'm not going to hell. So that is a really simplified, really basic toxic theology 101. It gets a lot more complicated than that. I'm sure that many of you here are hospice workers, maybe some chaplains who've encountered patients and clients and family members who are sitting at the bedside with their dying mother, let's say, and the mother is an atheist, and the daughter sitting at the bedside is a fundamentalist Christian and is freaking out because mom isn't saved and believes that mom is going to go to hell unless she's saved. And I've seen this many, many times as a chaplain, and I'm sure many of you have too. And so how do we help somebody like that? Because the theology that this person has is essentially toxic, which means that it does not support empowerment. It does not support peace and personal growth. It supports separation, superstition, creating a world in which there is us and the other, which is everything that is not us. So that's kind of a very quick definition of toxic theology. We can go into that in more detail, but just based on what I just said, I'm wondering if any of you would like to just kind of jump in and say something really quickly. And the way to do it is go into the chat box on the right-hand side of your screen and type in your question, and we'll open up your microphone. Or you can go ahead and unclick the mute thing on your microphone and go ahead and say something. Stanley, would you like to say something? Raise your hand if you have a comment. He says no. Okay. Brian, tell us a little bit about toxic theology that you grew up with.
Well, as Sarah was saying, Terry, we were talking about before we got started. I come from more an experiential point of view. Terry's studied toxic theology. I've lived it. So Terry mentioned earlier that I was raised evangelical, which is not quite correct. I was actually raised Pentecostal, which I would say is probably worse. Mm-hmm. My grandfather was a pastor, and I grew up in a church where I was taught from the time I can remember that I was a bad person, that I was born a bad person, that basically God hated me, and I couldn't understand why God created me in a way that he hated me. And I had a fear of hell, a fear of death, a fear of God, and I was told I had to love this God that I really perceived to be a monster. So I had to at least pretend to love him. So that was something I struggled with for my entire life. And in terms of how that impacted me in terms of my grief process, this is one of the things that kind of like kicked me out of that. I just said I couldn't take it anymore. When I was in my 20s, I guess, my uncle was murdered and my uncle was gay. And I remember talking to my brother. My brother, by this time, had converted to Catholicism. And we were just having a conversation. Said, well, you know, Uncle Michael's in hell. And I was like, what do you mean? Why would you believe that? And he said, well, because he never joined the church. He was never baptized. So therefore, he's in hell. And again, one of those things that just didn't make any sense to me, why God would create him this way. The church said you can't join the church. And because he couldn't join the church, you know, he was going to be tortured eternally. So that, if I had held on to that belief, it would have really, really complicated my grief. But instead, I went out and did a lot of studying of the Bible and theology and history and all that stuff, and basically kind of worked my way out of that.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey there, something I want to tell you about today. My podcast platform, Buzzsprout, has recently made it easier for me to allow you to support me financially. Go to www.grieftogrowth.com/subscribe. That's grief2growth.com/subscribe. And once you're there, you can sign up to support me financially. Now, you can do it for as little as $3 a month or, of course, as much as you'd like. If you do that, you'll get access to bonus episodes, and you'll see those in the regular feed. They'll have a lock on them. But when you become a subscriber, you'll actually get access to your own private feed, and you'll be able to listen to the regular podcast along with the bonus podcast for the subscribers. I want to thank you for listening. I want to thank you for sharing the podcast. And I want to thank those of you who support me financially. Have a great day, and on to the episode.
Wow. And here you are talking to us about this. You know, there's so much to say about this. As many of you know, we had the Afterlife Conference in Salt Lake City this year. And after the conference was over on Sunday afternoon, our hotel was just a few blocks from the Mormon church. And a bunch of us went down there and started talking to the people at the Mormon church in Salt Lake City. They have young students, very young people in their 20s, that walk around and talk to the visitors and answer the questions about Mormonism. And we asked them about their view of the afterlife. And they basically gave us this very detailed description of three levels of the afterlife that you go to. One, if you accept the gospel of Jesus Christ, another one, if you're not sure, and a third one, if you're a really bad person. And it was just fascinating to us to listen to these 20-year-old girls telling us this theology that they had been steeped in for their entire life. We also learned the story of Joseph Smith, who channeled the Book of Mormon, essentially. And this hell question is so interesting because in his story, he and his family were Christian. And he had a brother that was not baptized. And he was very freaked out after his brother died that his brother had not been baptized and was in hell, according to his belief system. Well, fast forward later in Joseph Smith's life, and he had this spiritually transformative experience where he talked to angels and channeled everything that became the Book of Mormon. And one of the things that he received was the message that there is no hell. There is no eternal punishment. So he felt much better about his brother. However, as he got more involved in creating this religion, he decided that he needed to baptize his brother posthumously, just in case. So it's very interesting to look at that just in case thinking. Many of us who know and feel for certain that there is no punishment, that sin and salvation is not a useful doctrine, still have it gnawing away at us somewhere inside. And when we're faced with trauma or loss, it comes up, it surfaces in us again. And it's, you know, the big question, why did this happen to me? What did I do wrong? What did I do to deserve my child dying? And I was a good person and I did everything right. And two things happen when you begin to ask those questions. You can either go to a place where you struggle, trying to find out and figure out what you did wrong within the confines of that theology. Or the other option is you can reject that theology entirely and go to a brand new theology and start exploring and seeking, which is what I think most of us here did.
Terry, so, Julietta said she'd like to share her story. So I'm going to unmute her and ask her to share her story.
Go for it.
All right, Julietta, you're on.
Hi, can you all hear me?
Yes.
My camera's actually not working, so I do apologize. So anyway, Brian, when you were speaking, I couldn't help but to relate with your story because I grew up in a Christian family. In fact, my grandfather is also a pastor. He's the only grandfather I have left alive. And they moved, they were originally in Houston, Texas, and him and my grandmother back in the 50s moved to Argentina as missionaries. So they kind of like left the whole evangelical, actually they were Baptist at the time. And when they moved to Argentina, they started a church, they planted a church, and they were going through like this whole movement about spirituality and the Holy Spirit and whatever. So they kind of were the outcast, so to say, from their families. So anyway, they lived down there for 35 years. I came into the picture some years later, and I was raised in this upbringing where we were, you know, I'm 43 years old. I struggled all my life with all these legalistic approaches of religion, and I'm the second daughter out of six girls, and I'm the one that kind of, I guess, the black sheep, so to say. So everything that I wanted to do, that I felt like doing, it seems like it was a sin, it was condemned. And this issue about death, you know, if you don't come to terms with it or make peace with God, etc., then you go to hell type of thing. So I had a lot of issues, and I still struggle with some of these things because I feel like I, based on the religious teachings that I received, and I'm not judging my family, I think they're fantastic people, but based on that religious teaching, I feel that I'm being judged and I don't deserve the pardon of God, and I, when I die, I go to hell based on some of the choices I've made in my life. And so, like being divorced and remarried, etc. And I refuse to believe that that is the way. And so, interestingly enough, my son is also a youth pastor today at one of our local churches here, and I live in Miami, Florida. And we have, you know, not arguments, but we discuss these things. And so he's very... he goes by biblical scripture, and that's how he makes his choices, which is fine, but I believe that God is missing in a lot of the interpretation of that, in the way they teach it today.
So, Julietta, I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. Aside from the religion that you were raised with, have you ever actually studied religious history and the origins of this Bible and how it was written and where it came from and what was happening, you know, politically and socially at the time and who wrote it, et cetera. Have you ever actually studied any of that?
No. In fact, I was kind of kept from it. And it wasn't until I went into nursing school. Mm-hmm. That was in my mid-20s. I went to a Catholic university, and one of the requirements was world religion. So that was my first exposure to other religions or some sort of study about background and things like that, because I was kind of like, I always assumed I'm not supposed to go there.
Yeah.
It's not, God doesn't want that, you know? And so when I'm taking this course, because it's mandatory, I went through a spiritual crisis. Mm-hmm. And that's when it all kind of started, where I started feeling, well, maybe I do have, you know, forgiveness. Maybe God is not who I thought he was. And so that's been like my life struggle. But yeah, and that's how I came across you, you know, you guys, because I've been kind of on the search about, you know, finding God in a different way. And so this is actually my first session that I joined with you guys, but I meant to go to that conference, the Afterlife. I just had a work event going on at the same time and I wasn't able to make it, but I'm actually very happy to be participating tonight. I already find it very healing.
Thank you.
Juliet, I wanted to say something to you because, you know, Terry mentioned earlier, when you go through this, you need to try to reconcile your theology or kind of reject your theology. For me, rejecting my theology was not an option. My grandfather was a pastor, my entire family. I was raised from this, like I said, from the time I could talk. So what I did was I just dug into it and did exactly what Terry talked about. I studied the history of where did the Bible come from? What are the translations? What was going on with the Jews when they wrote the Old Testament, when they wrote the Hebrew scriptures, when they wrote Leviticus? What was the reasoning behind that? You know, the things that Jesus said, you know, what do you really mean by that? I remember one time thinking like the Jesus Seminary, that was kind of going on when I was going through this. And I was told that those guys were evil. These intellectuals who were asking these questions, did Jesus really say that? Or Jesus really say this? So I went through my faith. I didn't reject it. I didn't walk away from it. I just really dug into it. And I realized the interpretation I was given was basically wrong. You know, the early church, some of the early church fathers, for example, were universalists. They believed that everyone was saved. And I thought that people had always believed this stuff about eternal conscious torment. So I would encourage you to dig into it and do your own studies.
Yeah, I want to add to that what Brian's talking about is the Jesus Seminar, which was a series of, conferences by religious scholars like John Dominic Crossan and Marcus Borg and these guys who their work is to do what is called historical critical study of religious history. So there's two ways of looking at religion. One is historical critical, which is what Brian's describing, and the other is devotional. Devotional means you read the scriptures, you say the prescribed prayers, you just follow the devotional prescription. Historical critical is you actually include history, archaeology, and anthropology in your study of your religious history. So it's really important to understand those two approaches. And that's why I asked you, Julieta, if you had ever done that kind of study, because what tends to happen is most of us are given our theology when we're 5 years old or 3 years old or 2 years old, you know, Sunday school theology. And they tell us the creation story and Adam and Eve and Noah's Ark and all that stuff. And we never think about it again, because why would we? So you're 5, now you're 9, now you're 12, now you're 15, now you're 22, and now you're 30. And you just kind of live in this culture where you're steeped in this stuff all the time. And there's no reason to question it until something traumatic happens. And you get in a terrible accident and you're paralyzed. Or a tsunami hits your city. Or your child dies. Or 9/11 happens. Or any of these traumatic things. And that's when you start to go, well, wait a minute. The God I was taught about really loves me. Loves everybody, but especially me because I'm a Christian. And why would this happen? And that's when most people start to question. So what that means is that most people in their 40s, 50s, 60s as adults are still living in a five-year-old's version of theology. And that's why it's so important to look at things like the Jesus Seminar. Do look that up. I'm going to type in some names of some authors here that you will find helpful. And Brian, while I'm typing, will you take over the conversation for a minute?
Sure. I just want to kind of echo what Terry said about, you know, this different way. And I kind of touched on it earlier of studying different. And I remember when I was starting this, people said, well, you don't need to read about the Bible. You just need to read the Bible. You know, you don't need all these books about the Bible. I had a friend literally tell me this just a few weeks ago. So why do you do all the studying about the Bible? Just read the Bible and the Holy Spirit will lead you to an understanding. But I don't agree with that. I think you have to study, like I said, what is the origin of this book? What why were they writing these things? What was the purpose? Who was the audience? And also, when you read the history of the church, you'll find out that these things they've told you have always been this way, have not always been this way, even within the church. So I expanded until, you know, I found something that made sense to me. I was told as a little kid, and this is what they'll do to you, and I hate to use the word cult, but they will indoctrinate you and say, don't listen to what anybody else tells you. Don't do your own study. Don't follow your own heart. You know, the heart is evil among all, you know, above all things. They'll tell you things like that. And I'm like, you know, I have to follow my own heart. God gave me this heart. He gave me wisdom. He gave me intelligence. Why would he not want me to explore? And even the Bible, when you read it properly, tells you to test the spirits by the spirit. So, you know, and to study, to show yourself approved and to be ready to give an answer to every man for why you have your faith. So that's right there in the Bible too. But a lot of our pastors tell us, don't read that. Just listen to me.
And I want to respond to Sue here. Sue posted a question in the chat room as a clinical hypnotherapist. She is wondering about some tools that will help with her clients. So Sue, what I do with my students and clients to help them unhook from these religious garbs is I teach, I'll give you an example. My mother died recently, and I had the great honor of being the facilitator for her funeral. And most of the people there were Jewish. They were either Jewish or non-religious or just traditional in a small space of spiritual tradition. And what I did with the funeral is I incorporated some traditions from shamanism that were very religiously neutral. So for example, and this is something you can do with your clients, to express grief at the funeral, I had everybody pick three rose petals and blow into each rose petal a certain thing. And the first rose petal, you blow your grief and your pain. In the second rose petal, you blow your beautiful memories of the person who's died. Or this can work for a traumatic experience, whatever you're doing. The third rose petal, you blow your prayers for the future, your hopes, your intentions for healing, a message you want to give to a loved one on the other side, whatever is the context. And so giving them tools from other cultures and other traditions that are not offensive to their tradition really works to sort of open their minds. It's like, wow, you mean I can pray without Jesus? I can ask for divine direction without using the words God or sin or salvation or any of the words in the prayer. So what I would suggest to you, Sue, is to do some studying of other cultures and borrow some of their traditions to use as tools for your clients. Now, some people call this cultural appropriation or misappropriation, some people would say. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I think that it is misappropriation if we don't really study it and we don't really know what we're doing and we just walk around pretending to be African shamans or whatever. You gotta really do the work and you gotta really study it. And in that case, it is appropriate to borrow it. Stanley, did you have something you wanted to say? Unmute your mic, there you go.
Am I on now?
Yes.
Okay, good. I'm very happy to be here and meet you all, friends. I'm Stanley. I come from Kenya and I'm here now in Richmond, Indiana at Allen School of Religion. It's a Quaker school. I wanted to share something about my experience with this question that we have at hand here. Coming from Kenya and from a shamanic background, I wanted to share that the question about death, about the people who would talk about the how theologies can be toxic, is that we have a good way to approach it in my shamanic understanding, and that is that that God is in everything for us. God occupies every space, every air, even in death, God is there. And so we do understand death as something. You are always with us. You don't disappear. I mean, even though we can't see you, we know that you are always around with us. We can communicate with you. You can communicate with us. And so the idea that you are going to hell, I mean, for us does not arise. I mean, there's nothing like, because we believe that even though you are not there, you are still there. You are still with us. You still talk to us. We are still with you. And you are still with us. And we continue to always communicate. And you communicate through dreams. You communicate through trees, through water, through air, through fire, through our family members. And so so we do not have that worry, that fear. But as a chaplain, I did my internship at a hospital in Marin, and one of the incidences that I encountered was a family who were very, very worried about their kin who was just about to die, and they were very concerned that this kin was not going to be going to heaven. And so I said to them, you know, could I share with you something from how we understand it from my community? And they were very, very adamant. They said, if it's not a Christian community, if it's not a Christian or a biblical understanding, we don't want to hear anything about it. And so I said to them, well, if that is how you prefer to understand it, I'm probably just going to bring you somebody who has that kind of understanding, you know, somebody who comes from a Christian tradition to help you. But the idea that this loved one is going to go to hell, I said, I in my community and where I come from, we don't believe that. But if you do believe that, then I'm going to find you somebody who can help you with that.
That's true. And that's what a chaplain would do. And while we're talking about chaplaincy, Stanley and I went to school together. And it's nice to see you. It looks like you're still in school. Looks like you're sitting in the classroom right there.
That's right. I am actually in a computer.
And we actually graduated together.
That's true. We did. Yes.
So one thing to think about hell, as Bishop Spohn would say, hell is an invention of the church. There is nothing in scripture anywhere that says that bad people, and how do we define bad, go to hell and burn for eternity. This was completely made up by the church. And one of the things you learn when you begin to study religious history is how these doctrines came about. They did not come from Jesus, and they did not come from scripture, either Hebrew or Christian scripture. They came from the four councils of bishops that took place over 200 years after Jesus died. You probably heard of the Council of Nicaea. Well, there were three other ones. And these bishops got together and basically hammered out a document, just kind of like in America, they came up with the Constitution. They came up with the doctrines of the church and organized it because it had become a social, political institution instead of a spiritual path. And that social political institution is what most of us have been given as our religion. And this is why it's so important to really go into some of these books that we are suggesting here and find out the origins of this. And for those of you who are asking about how do you help your family members and your patients and your clients, education is the answer. And it's very common in religious organizations to look at education with suspicion. They say education is the enemy of faith. And you know what? It kind of is, because it's the enemy of Sunday school faith. But what education really is about faith is it doesn't destroy your faith, it actually makes it better. So I'm going to give you another example from my own family, which is what I call socially Jewish. Nobody in my family has ever read anything about theology, much less the Hebrew Bible or anything from it. But they like to celebrate Passover and the holidays and all of that. And I sort of stopped participating in that decades ago because I wanted something deeper. And as the years went by and I got more educated in theology, I approached my sister recently and I said, can I come to your Passover Seder and tell a story and facilitate something and lead part of the Seder? Because I had discovered something really beautiful about the Passover story and the Exodus from Egypt, which, by the way, is not factual or historical, but is symbolic of the spiritual quest, where essentially we're born into slavery by being born into bodies, and we spend our entire lifetime, 40 years at the time, trying to find our way home to the promised land, back to union with the divine, blah, blah, blah. And I wanted to share this with my sister and her family, and I was very rudely dismissed, to put it mildly. They didn't want to know. She said, I don't want to know this story. I want to read the Haggadah from the box of matzah that you buy at the grocery store, and that's about as far as I want to go into this. And it caused a huge rift in my family, because that belief is that education is the enemy of faith. And what I was coming with is, let me show you this beautiful story that will give your faith meaning. Because what mostly happens is people are attached to the myth and not the meaning. And it's really important to remember myth versus meaning and separate those two things.
I do want to add one thing here, Terry. You know, Julietta kind of touched on this earlier about, you know, when you start to do this study, and I think we talked about, you know, losing your faith. And you talked about losing the Sunday school faith. There, when I went through my path, there are some points of crisis. And I remember several times when I would find something out that I found out wasn't true, I'm like, am I pulling this whole house of cards apart? Is the whole thing going to fall down? And am I going to lose my faith? And I remember reading certain books about like the 6,000-year-old earth that I believe we lived on, that was created by God in 7 days. And when I dropped that, I'm like, okay, what else isn't true? But I will say that my faith today, 30 years after I probably started on this, it's stronger than it's ever been, but it's totally different. And there have been these points of crisis. So when you hit those points, you just have to kind of push through them, and something bigger actually opens up, at least for me, every time.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi there. I'm really excited to tell you about my latest ebook. It's 4 lessons that you can learn from the near-death experience without going through all the trouble of dying to learn them. I've been studying NDEs for several years now. I am completely convinced that not only are they 100% real, but that there's some very universal wisdom that we can get from the near-death experience. And I've distilled that down in this book into 4 short lessons. And I've also given you all the reasons why I believe the NDEs are absolutely real. So go to www.grieftogrowth.com/NDE lessons to pick it up for free. www.grieftogrowth.com/NDE lessons. I hope you enjoy it.
So here's a question for you, Brian, and for all of you who've done this. When you do start pulling away from that, you lose friends, you lose, you know, relationships. How did you deal with that, Brian? I'm sure there were people in your family that.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. I'm the black sheep of my family for sure. They just kind of, it's my family dynamics. They don't argue, they just ignore me. So they just let me go and do my own thing and just rant and rave, I guess. I don't know really what they think about me. It's interesting also though, my parents, their faith has evolved over the years. So I'll have conversations with my mother sometimes and I'll say, you know, obviously you believe this and you believe that. And she'll say, no, I actually don't believe that anymore. So I've seen their, you know, their faith, you know, kind of change. So, yeah, there've been some people I've had to leave behind. You know, I've left churches, and I've had people that say, I have a good buddy right now. He's a straight up evangelical, And we walk every so often. We walk for a couple of miles and we'll just talk about things. And he said, Brian, you know, just to do me a favor, when you get home, just read one of the Gospels, one of the Gospels, and just pray to God to open up your eyes about Jesus. Mm-hmm. And I was like, Bill, I've been studying Jesus since I was 5 years old. I'm 58 now. I don't think reading one of the Gospels over again is going to change. In fact, the more I read about Jesus, that's how I've come to the understanding that I have now. So, you know, Jesus even said that, you know, the gospel would separate families, and, you know, sometimes it will, and you may lose people in your family when you do, you know, take this journey, but do you want to live with a toxic theology that makes you feel terrible about yourself, that makes you anxious, that makes you judgmental, or do you want to be free of that? And that's the choice that I had to make.
And you also have to redefine family, and, you know, you've heard the term family of origin versus family of choice.
Absolutely.
I had a very large and close family of origin that I have no relationship with anymore because of this. There's one of them that remains, which is, interestingly, my father, who's 92 and a Holocaust survivor. And he is open-minded and supportive, and he's still in my life, which is wonderful. But this is why the monks and the sages and the early church fathers and the desert mothers went off to live alone in a cave, because as they were pursuing their spiritual path, they realized that they could not hold on to those old identities and those families. I mean, even the story of Jesus, where he's recruiting people to follow him and leave their families behind, which isn't actually how it happened. They actually did bring their wives and families with them, but that's another story. we have, and this is where Buddhism kind of crosses over with it, where we're taught about non-attachment. So we have this life, we have this family, we have this community, we have this safe little Sunday school belief system. What we are supposed to do as souls on a journey of awakening is to be brave enough to shed a lot of that. And in doing that, just like, you know, look at the story of Buddha. You know, he walked away from wealth and royalty and all the comforts of, you know, to go live at this austere life. And all our religious heroes did that in one form or another. That's a whole other story. But I guess what I'm trying to say about this is you're going to lose family. You're going to lose friends. And you just have to be the bigger person and, you know, to know that they're on their journey and they are where they are and you are where you are and it's all love and it's all good. That sounds awfully flowery and woo-woo, but I'm not sure what else to say about that. I want to talk a little bit about grief because all this toxic theology is, and this is great, but I want to talk about how it affects grief. So there are... I actually think I'm going to put this in the message box. The grief researchers today, who grief theory is very different now than it was 30 years ago, have identified certain qualities that enable us to be resilient when facing loss and trauma. And I actually have one of these here that I might be able to paste in so that you can see this. And I actually pasted this into another one of these. Hold on a second. Sorry to divert everything. There it is. So there are certain, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and those five stages of grief, just throw that out the window. That's not even a thing anymore. That never was a thing. It was, her research was highly misunderstood and over popularized by pop spirituality. There are no stages of grief, but what there are tasks of grieving, things that you have to do, just like a task, like you have to put gas in the car and clean the house and empty the trash. And there's something called the six R's of mourning. I'm typing that in here. You can Google it. That was developed by a well-known grief researcher. And there's certain things that you go through, like recognizing the loss, reacting to the pain, recollecting the life that you had before the loss, reconstructing the life that you're going to have after the loss. There's also something called, they call it the dual process model, where in grief, you spend some time focusing on your loss, being sad, crying, angry, whatever you have to feel, And then you vacillate or oscillate back and forth to other times where you're focusing on your recovery, thinking about, well, should I sell the house? You know, maybe I'll get rid of his clothes in the closet or whatever. So you go a little bit to loss, a little bit to restoration, loss, restoration, back and forth. That's a healthy process of grieving. When somebody spends more time in loss than in restoration, that's where we start to go into what we call complicated grief. And it's very interesting. This is what I noted in my doctoral research when I worked on this, is that all the grief research out there today points out things that can contribute to complicated grief, but completely ignores religious belief. It hasn't even been studied yet. And it's one of the biggest complicating factors. And the biggest belief that gets in the way is prayer. There's two kinds of prayer that people normally indulge in. One's called intercessory prayer and one's petitionary prayer. Petitionary prayer means you petition God to give you what you want. Please, God, don't let me have cancer. Intercessory prayer is where you pray on behalf of someone else. So your church group will start a prayer circle for you to help heal your cancer. This kind of prayer is what gets us in the most trouble with complicated grief, because despite all the prayer, you still end up with cancer. Or the person that you're praying for to not die dies anyway. And if you believe that this kind of prayer works and that God listens to you and responds, and then God doesn't listen and doesn't respond, what happens? Cognitive dissonance, crisis of faith, spiritual crisis. So this is what happens with grief. This is why I'm bringing it up, because with the people that I've worked with who have religious issues, this is where it always gets tripped up. Comments on that, anybody? Oh, yeah. Gretchen is mentioning Joseph Smith and his vision of hell, and saying what we talked about earlier, where Joseph Smith had this now information from spirit that there's no hell because it helped him with his, you know, get over his belief about his brother being in hell. So, you know, one of the things that's so complicated about chaplaincy, and I know that some of you here are chaplains, is we are called upon to visit patients in their hospital rooms or hospice beds and ask to pray for them. And they'll say, please, chaplain, you know, pray for me, pray for healing. And this was something that drove me crazy about being a chaplain, is what I would pray for is I would say, we open up our hearts to spirit, to our divine purpose, whatever that may be. And we ask that we have the strength and the wisdom and the vision to go forward with this challenge in the highest possible way, with eyes wide open and hearts wide open, period, end of prayer. And I have had many people get very pissed off at me for saying a prayer like that, because that's not what they wanted to hear. They wanted me to ask God to heal them. So another example I'm going to give about this that's also in my book is a very famous story. It was on the news all over the place. There was a 10-year-old kid in school who was diagnosed with brain cancer. And there was this famous news story, and the news crew came to the classroom and filmed the kids. And here's the little kid with brain cancer sitting there in his wheelchair, basically kind of half dead. And the teacher says to the kids, let's pray for a miracle. And the news crew's interviewing these kids, and they're saying, if we pray for Kyler, God will listen to us and heal him. And all the kids are saying this, and the teacher's encouraging this. Well, of course, 6 months later, little Kyler dies. And these children are now not only dealing with the grief over the loss of their friend, but they're going home to their parents saying, I don't get it. We asked God to heal him and God didn't listen. So they're bringing these intense theological questions home to their parents who are not equipped to answer them, and beginning their crisis of faith. So I wanted to throw that out there for any comments that some of you have. And I'm going to respond to Julie, who we're back to talking about Mormons. Julie, we were all in Salt Lake City recently and spent a half a day with the Mormons, and they do believe in hell. They have three worlds. The first world is, I'm hoping I'm saying this. It's the world of the sun that you go to when you die. The second world is the world, and you go to the world of the sun, to the light, when you believe the gospel of Jesus Christ. The second world you can go to is the world of the moon, where you're a very good person, but you haven't really accepted the gospel. That's okay, you go to the moon. And the third world is called the world of the stars, which is their version of hell, where you go if you're a really bad person. And they were explaining this to us, and I was so tempted to say to them, but wait a minute, don't you guys know that the sun is a star? Same world, but I didn't want to beat up on them too bad. So yes, there is a belief in hell in Mormonism. Islam believes in hell too, but Islam is part of the Abrahamic trilogy. It comes from the same foundation. So I could talk about this forever. I would rather listen to what you guys have to say. Terrestrial kingdom. Thank you, Sarah. And outer darkness. I guess there's different words for it. But basically there were these three levels, and there is an idea of hell. So, and Julie's also saying the most hurtful thing is when religion justifies the death by saying the person was not worthy. This is toxic theology at its best. So how do we, if we are chaplains and counselors and whatever we are in this group, how do we help people with this?
Well, one thing I would add, Terry, because the whole thing about healing and prayer, I talked to lots of healers in my work, and I actually interviewed a guy a few weeks ago who was a healer and does miraculous kinds of healings, right? And I said, so what happens? Does everybody get healed? And of course, the answer is no. So we as adults understand that sometimes there's a time to be healed, sometimes there's a time for to not be healed, and sometimes there's a time for us to die.
Death is also healing.
Exactly. Yeah. Death can definitely be a healing, and that's the thing that we've got to understand and come away from, that sickness is a punishment, that death is a punishment, that death is the ultimate punishment and is at the end. And that's what leads to this toxic theology that says the worst thing possible happened, she died. And you and I know that nobody ever dies. And if we can move beyond that perspective, then we don't see this as a punishment.
Yes. And now, you know, today we're in a political arena where they're bringing back the death penalty. we talked about this the other day, Brian, and this just gives you, an example of how our culture is so unable to deal with death that, you know, we kill people as a punishment, but you know, we don't want to get political here. Let's see. Anybody else want to say something? Stephen Finley, say something. I know you have something to say. Can you unmute your microphone?
You find Stephen.
I see him there, but I can't see his microphone. Oh, wait, hold on. I can't. Okay, I don't know. He doesn't seem to have a microphone. Okay, well, Stephen, we'll talk to you later. Unless you can find your little microphone icon and unmute it. I'm not seeing it.
Michelle, would you like to tell us about the crisis of faith you said you reached earlier?
Well, I really did have a crisis of faith when I was, I think the first inkling was when I was 7 and I went to parochial school. I was raised Catholic and I was in my religious class, my religion class, which we had daily. And my nun was teaching us about the loaves and the fishes. And I raised my hand and I said, that doesn't make sense. And she said, well, you have to have faith. And she kept on with the story, and I raised my hand and I said, no, I'm really sorry. It really does not make sense. And this went on for 5 or 10 minutes, and she finally sent me to the principal's office. But then following hard after that was we learned that if you're not baptized, you go to either purgatory or hell. And so all babies that die before being baptized go to hell or go to purgatory, if best case scenario. And it just, and I was about 7 or 8 years old and it offended my soul. And I thought that cannot be right. That a good God cannot possibly cast off these innocent babies. And so we went forward from there. And by the time I was 12, I was pretty much done. And I told Brian earlier last week at 12, I had a white light experience where I was taking my mother's soup and I spilled it on myself and scalded myself and ran to my room, and I was really upset and in a lot of pain, and I was surrounded by white light. And it was that ineffable, massive love and compassion that you experience when you experience spirit. And nothing was said to me, but it was communicated to me that it was, I was completely loved. And I was given such a feeling of love and compassion that I came out of that experience knowing that I had no fear of death, that what was on the other side didn't exist with hell. It was pure love and compassion. And that buoyed me. I mean, seriously, the only time I ever had fear of death after that was when I had babies and I had to be there for them. But I have no fear of death. I did, in that experience, ask for, and I don't pray because I think, I never prayed because I thought it was like asking for something. And so I prayed, I asked during this white light experience for the sword of wit. And I was given it because I was a very shy, sweet little girl who was really offended at how sadistically the priests and nuns were treating children. And so I went into the eighth grade with this sword of wit and used it and never got in trouble because I was able to at least plant a seed in their mind that what they were doing was incredibly cruel. And only once did get in trouble, but it was worth it. So that was my experience. And I ignored religion completely. Oh, no, I didn't ignore religion completely. When I was in the eighth grade, we had a comparative religion study. And we went to a Jewish temple. And I started arguing the way I would argue with the priests and nuns, and they would shut me down. I started arguing, not in a bad way, but in an intellectual way. I was arguing with the rabbi, and he argued back. And I was so lit up. I went home from that experience, and I said to my mother, I'm converting to Judaism. And I did actually convert to Judaism when my husband and I got married. But that doesn't mean that I have gone to temple. Nor does it mean, it just means, I don't even know what it means. Religion has not been, so I feel a little out of place here because religion hasn't been very predominant in my life, but I have a very strong sense of the love of God. And much like, I'm sorry, I forgot your name, but the Kenyan gentleman, much like your philosophy, that's kind of my philosophy, that God is, we are God. God is in everything. And also like the lady who is the hypnotherapist, I am a hypnotherapist and I don't come up with people who are super religious very often, but I sure would like to know some tools and some way of sort of diffusing that situation.
So, Michelle, and for all the therapists here, not to toot my own horn, but I'm going to. This is a good time to pitch my book. My new book, Grief and God, actually has a lot of tools in it. It has a whole section on processes and techniques that you can do with clients and students and anybody who needs it to help them work through that stuff. There's a whole section on there called Why Counseling Doesn't Work. And so when we look at the grief counseling world, traditional counseling is you sit with a counselor for 50 minutes a week or a month and you talk. That's called narrative therapy. And it's great for people who don't normally talk. For some people, talking about what they're experiencing is a really big step. But for people who are used to talking, that doesn't help much. And talk therapy, in my opinion, is really pretty useless and just keeps the therapists, you know, having clients coming back and paying the bills every week. I'm a really big believer in you have to do solution-focused therapy, which is you give your client a tool or a process or a ceremony or something to do every week, some sort of homework, so that they can actually take action. And ritual and ceremony is a really huge part of this. So many years ago, I had a guy who was struggling with religious symbols, and he had crosses and pictures of Jesus all over his house, and he didn't want that anymore. And I really simple, just take all that stuff and put it in a box. You don't have to burn it in a fire. That's a little too much, but put it in a box and put it in away in the closet in another room and get yourself used to the idea of not living with these symbols. Just the action of putting something in a box and moving it from point A to point B is a healing process. That's why we do ceremonies like blowing into rose petals. I did a ceremony for myself recently where I was wanting to let go of a particular attachment that I had. I drew a picture of that attachment. I went out into my yard. I dug a hole. I made a grave for it. I put the picture in the grave. I filled up the hole. I threw some flowers over it. I said some prayers and I released it. It's all symbolic. So by symbolically taking that feeling or that attachment, whatever it is, scribbling it on a little piece of paper and burning it in a fire, throwing it in a river, burying it in the earth, just moves the energy from point A to point B. So very simple, very simply put, that's one way that you help clients is you use symbolic representations of the thing that they're trying to move and help them move that forward. And there's tons of stuff like that in the book. Stephen, you want to say something now? Raise your hand if you want to talk. We'll unmute you. He's raising his hand. Okay, here we go. Hi. Speak.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, I think a good place for a lot of people who were raised in a very fundamentalistic Christian environment would be to read someone like Bishop John Spong.
Yes.
He does a really good job of deconstructing the fundamentalistic background of the Christian religion. He's considered the spokesperson for a movement called Progressive Christianity, which you can all look up. They have a website. They believe in Christianity. However, they state emphatically that they don't believe that Christianity has a monopoly on all truth. He does a really good thing about hell when he talks about how hell was invented, because the church specializes in guilt and shame and fear for control. You can find him on YouTube.
I'm going to put the link on right now. I'm looking for it.
Yeah, and he's a really good person, I think, if you're coming from a real fundamentalistic burn and turn eternity formation, as was discussed. You can be a PhD in business or science and still be 5 years old emotionally from your religious indoctrination that we all go through. It's almost like a rite of passage, I guess. I think about the whole scope of Carl Jung's sense of what he calls, you know, individuation. Did I say it right?
Individuation.
Yes, but the practice of beginning to work through what you've been taught by your family, by your society, and coming to your own, you know, not just inheriting an opinion, but coming to your own opinion, that takes a lot of work. It can be very scary. And as you said, it can be a lonely process. And why so many people don't want to think. They want to just go with, whether it's political or religious or social economic, they just want to go with what everyone, you know, what the status quo is saying. So There we have it. Anyway, so, those are some of my first thoughts.
Okay. I want to offer something here too. I just put a URL in there for Fowler's Stages of Faith. There was a psychologist in the 1960s named James Fowler, and he came up with a system that he calls Stages of Faith. I like to call it Styles of Faith. So some of you who've studied psychology probably remember like Erik Erikson and Kohlberg and the people who did the developmental charts, like when you're 2 years old, you should be able to do this. And when you're 7 years old, you should process information this way, blah, blah, blah. Fowler took these developmental milestones and applied them to how we understand images of God. And I put a link here for that. This is in my book as well. And he's got these stages that begin with infantile understanding of God. So here's an explanation of what an infantile understanding of God is. It's a story. A four-year-old kid is walking on the beach with his dad, sees a dead seagull on the sand. Daddy, what happened to the bird? Daddy says, it died and went to heaven. The kid looks up at heaven, looks down at the dead bird and says, did God throw it back down? That's an infantile stage one, stage two concept of the divine. As we mature in a healthy way, hopefully, we move to a better understanding than that, which is stage three, let's say. And in stage three, we still have a little bit of that, but we're kind of going back and forth by saying, well, you know, wait a minute, there's no God in the sky with a bird in his hand that's throwing it down to earth. It probably doesn't work that way. Like Michelle, you were saying when you were 12 or whatever age that was. So most, so Fowler identified all these levels of understanding. It's a brilliant piece of work. And what we know in America, let's say, is that most people are somewhere between stage two and stage three. They're still not completely sure that there's not a God in the sky that throws the bird back down. But they also know that that doesn't exactly feel right either. And most people, again, this is the Sunday school indoctrination to religion, stay in that Sunday school thing until trauma pushes them out of it or causes them to question it. So if you're interested in learning more about this, and it's really helpful for chaplains, when you're working with patients and you're familiar with Fowler's stages, you can very easily identify where that patient is in their faith. And as we're supposed to do, meet them where they are or try to, you know, understand what their thinking is. So I just put a link in there, which is really great for everybody so that I hope you use it.
And, you know, it's interesting you talked about most people stay in that stage of faith until the trauma pushes them out of it. And I was just thinking about Michelle's story and my own. Some of us are traumatized by that very story. I remember reading the book of Revelation when I was a child, and just, it was worse than any Stephen King novel I could ever read. And so I was traumatized by that very thing, but most people seem to be able to, and even in my own family, my brothers and sisters went to the same Sunday school that I did, and they seem to be fine with it. But for me, I found it traumatic, and I had to start pushing back against it right away. But you make a good point. Most people can accept that Sunday school version and sometimes into their 80s. You know, I know people that still believe that and just never seem to have gotten pushed out of it.
Well, I wonder, Brian, if, you know, the reason some people are comfortable with those horror stories and the Bible is full of them. Another thing you should look for online is Bishop Spong, talking about him again. It's a talk or whatever it's called, Terrible Text of the Bible. The horror stories throughout the Bible are far worse than any Stephen King novel. And why do some kids get traumatized by that and some don't? I wonder if it's because of the belief of, if you're a good boy and a good girl, this won't happen to you.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. But you know, it's funny. I had a friend. He actually worked for the church. He was a fundamentalist. He had been a missionary, a secret missionary. He would go overseas and you know, do mission work in places you're not supposed to do it. But I remember he became a hardcore atheist at some point. And I said, John, what happened to you? He said, well, I just started looking at the story of Noah's Ark, and I realized the story makes no sense. That it doesn't make any sense that God would do this, and what a terrible. And so he just threw the whole thing out at that point. He said, I don't believe in anything. I don't believe in the afterlife. I don't believe in any of this anymore. So that faith that he thought was so rock solid was built on such a shaky foundation that once he said, and I said, well, John, you can't take the story literally, but he couldn't get there.
Yeah, because when you talk to a five-year-old, they take everything literally. If you tell a five-year-old that there's a boogeyman in the closet, they're never going to open that door to the closet. They're going to be so terrified, right? They believe everything. That's what's so vulnerable about children. So when that's implanted in your mind at 5 years old and you take everything literally, without the proper help and guidance and education and support, how do you ever unhook from that? I mean, some of us are on a path where we're obviously intended to unhook from that, and other people are not. Pat, let me unmute you here. All right. Wait a minute. Oops, why didn't that work? There you go.
Hello, and thank you. Thank you very much. I'd like to contribute this aspect of my own personal awareness with my own crisis. I've had a lot of crises in my life, but the biggest one was when I was always in search of something bigger and better. Something bigger and better meaning God, the concept of God. But why isn't God in this person, or I can't see it in this person? That was as a little girl and growing up. But it was not until I started going from like church to church as a student and at university that I became aware that, wow, you know, the poets that I read books, you know, that we were required to read, English literature and that kind of thing. It was all like, but isn't that God? I mean, couldn't I find, isn't that love? I mean, it's like, oh, the Shakespearean sonnets, whatever. Anyway, but I was too young to really understand a word that I want to kind of point out. And the word for me was, well, first, let me tell this, that I went from church to church. So I became from a Baptist to a Catholic. It's like, oh, the Catholics have it. I can go into the Catholic church and I can sit and I can commune with this bigness, this big whatever it is out there. But it was more like sitting there alone. It was not sitting there with other people or somebody else telling me the same thing in other words or from another book that I had gotten when I was younger, all of which felt very controlling. It was not until I was maybe 60 years old or a little more, even though I was still on the search, still on the path, still going here, temples here, Buddhism here, took the nine principles of Buddhism or whatever, still in search. And what I have come to know as a result of this experience, I was on my knees on the kneeler in a Catholic church here locally, and I realized, I said to myself, but a little more audible, oh Lord, I am worthy. I couldn't say I am not worthy. Let me be. I forgot. I can't even remember the words now because I've forgotten it. But it's like, oh Lord, I am worthy. So I've forgotten the rest of the prayer or whatever that you say with this.
It's called the sinner's prayer.
Yes, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. But what came for me after all that experience as a human being, a human soul, I felt that I had come into a wisdom from within, that the wisdom was within me as long as I continued to search. In other words, if I'm going to say, pray for me that, you know, I had this heart attack, help me, you know, get beyond it or whatever, then I'm giving up my power to you to do for me what I should be doing for myself.
Right.
And so what I'm saying is that in what all of you have said is the same thing that I've experienced, but I call it wisdom. And so for me, spirit speaks to me, guides me through an energy process, I feel. I can't see it. You know, I just feel it. Sometimes it's emotional, sometimes it isn't. Sometimes it's laughter, whatever it is. And sometimes it's even using four-letter words. It's whatever I need to do to express who I am. And I am seeing that some days I feel this way that I'm expressing now, some days I don't. But for today, I know who I am and I know what I am. I also know how I serve.
Well, well done. And thank you for mentioning the sinner's prayer. I just posted it in the chat room. There is a grief group called griefshare.com. They are on Facebook. I mention them in my book because they promote the worst kind of toxic theology you can ever imagine. And I never thought in a million years I would see this kind of toxic theology in a grief group. But if you go to their webpage and you click on the thing about why we suffer or how to heal or something like that, they say that the reason you're in pain from your grief is because you're a sinner. Because you have sinned and you have disobeyed God, and that's why you feel pain. As if the death of your child or your husband or your dog or whatever you love should not have pain. The only reason you feel pain is because you're a sinner. And they recommend this sinner's prayer as the thing that you should do to ease your pain. So toxic theology is promoted everywhere. It's just kind of like, you know, if you're on some sort of special diet and you're not supposed to eat sugar, but there's sugar in everything, right? It's in ketchup, it's in wine, it's in everything. You just can't see it. That's what toxic theology is. This is a perfect wrap up for the conversation, actually. So it's you know, so be careful of what you're looking at. You know, when you, well, you guys are smart and you know what to look for, but even in some of these grief groups and support groups, you're going to find toxic theology in there because basically, everybody's still stuck in that Sunday school five-year-old theology, and they're afraid to move out of it. I have a friend who, on the surface, appears to be like very woo-woo and new age, and she's into crystals and meditation, and she goes to India, and she does all that. But when her children were born, and this was, you know, 30 years ago, she had them baptized in the Catholic Church, just in case, just because she wanted to make sure that they were going to be okay, even though on the outside, you know, she professed to know that that's not viable. So you're going to run into a lot of that. Another thing I want to say kind of in closing here, this is my closing wrap, is I write about this in my book as well. Beware of New Age theology as well. Because a lot of it is just this same old Judeo-Christian theology wearing a different coat. And basically, I talk a lot in my book about The Secret and the Law of Attraction as it is popularly promoted, which is not what it really is. And about if you think the right thoughts, say the right words, do the right meditations, manifest, think positive, don't think negative, blah, blah, you know all this, then you will be rewarded. This is absolutely no different than if you say Hail Marys, go to church, believe in Jesus, don't have sex, don't dance, whatever the thing is, it's exactly the same. So, you know, I caution people to, you know, to do like Pat is describing, is just go into your own heart and listen to where your soul leads you. That's where the truth is. But do read and study, look at all these books that we've been talking about here. I hope that you will save this chat. If you want, by the way, a recording of this conversation with the chat room attached, please email me at office@afterlifeconference.com and I'll have your email address and I will send the recording link out to you tomorrow. If you don't email me, I won't know to send it. It will be in our newsletter next month, and I think most of you are newsletter subscribers. If you're not, go to afterlifeconference.com and subscribe. And Brian, do you have some closing words?
I just want to say thank you to everyone for your participation. And I hope this helped. And I want to also give a little bit of plug for Terry's book, which I finished today. And a lot of what we discuss is in the book and a lot more. So it's a great resource if you're dealing with clients that are going through this toxic theology and trying to help them navigate through that.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, everybody. And thank you so much, Brian. I absolutely adore you and love working with you.
Terry, it's great seeing you again. It's been a while.
Yeah, it has. And all my friends, Stanley, Stephen, Edwina, so nice to see you. It's been such a long time. So I love you all, and I thank you all so much. And if you're not on...
Well, that's it for another episode of Grief to Growth. This is your host, Brian Smith. I want to thank you for joining me today. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Feel free to reach out to me anytime at www.grieftogrowth.com. That's www.grief2growth.com. And you may know I am a life coach and grief partner. So if you'd like to schedule a free half-hour consultation and see how we might work together, you can do that on my website at grief2growth.com. Thanks a lot and have a wonderful day. Hey there, if you liked this episode, come on over and talk about it. Let me know what you liked. If you didn't like this episode, come on over and talk about it. Let me know what you didn't like. Go to grieftogrowth.com/community and look for Talk About the Podcast. I'll see you there.